animals tend to sneak into my poems, whether they were intended to be there or not. And I've learned simply to let them be when they come.
Welcome to the seventh episode of Rice Pudding Poetry, featuring surrealist poet Andrew Merton, whose dreamlike, comical poems about animals welcome a spirit of playfulness and fun. We also have jazz musicians Ben Baldwin and Kent Allen with us. And of course, we wouldn't be Rice Pudding without our community readers, Patrick Healy, Mary Anker, Tony Lee, and Cynthia Chattis have joined us for this episode, and they've brought poems about many-named cats, a dog named Gus, piggywigs, and jub-jub birds. I'm your host, Kimberly Green, and I wonder if you remember an old song called The Animal Fair. I learned the lyrics as a little girl. Here are a couple of verses you might recall. I went to the animal fair. The birds and the beasts were there. The big baboon by the light of the moon was combing his auburn hair. You should have seen the monk. He sat on the elephant's trunk. The elephant sneezed and fell on his knees, and that was the end of the monk. The monk, the monk, the monk. This show borrows that song's zany spirit, and we're so glad you've joined us for the animal fair ahead. Let's bring in a glowworm to light the way.
Two. One, two, three.
Shine, little glowworm, glimmer, glimmer. Shine, little glowworm, glimmer, glimmer. Lead us lest too far we wander. Love, sweet voices calling yonder. Shine, little glowworm, glimmer, glimmer. Hey there, don't get dimmer, dimmer. Light the path below, above, and lead us on to love. Glow, little glowworm, fly up fire. Glow like an incandescent wire. Glow for the female of the species. Turn on the AC and the DC. This night could use a little brightening. Light up your little old bug of lightning. When you gotta glow, you gotta glow. Glow, little glowworm, glow. Glow. Should get to sparking. I got a gal that I love so. Glow, little glowworm, glow. Glow, little glowworm, turn the key on. You are equipped with the tail light neon. You got a cute best pocket Mazda, which you can make both slow and faster. I don't know who you took a shine to, or who you're out to make a sign to. I got a gal I love so. Glow, little glowworm, glow. Glow, little glowworm, glow. Glow, little glowworm, glow.
That was Ben Baldwin and Kent Allen performing Johnny Mercer's The Glowworm. Ben and Kent are anchors of Ben Baldwin and the Big Note, and they have been performing their signature interpretations of jazz, swing, jump, and blues standards in the Seacoast area for over 40 years. On this show, you'll be hearing Ben on sax and Kent on guitar and keyboards. Our featured poet, Andrew Merton, says that along with writers like Raymond Carver, whose style is succinct and accessible, Andy's training as a newspaper reporter helped to shape his no-wasted words poem-making. Charles Simic's fatalistic humor and surrealism have also informed Andy's sensibility and style. His parents, he told me, were trilingual, and he remembers listening to them pun back and forth in French, German, and English. All these years later, the punning stays with him. Humor, he says, is central to his work and to his life. Andy's poetry has appeared in numerous literary journals, and he's the author of 3 full-length collections of poetry. He is a professor emeritus of English at the University of New Hampshire. We're honored to welcome Andy Merton to this show, along with his mad menagerie of feathered and four-legged friends.
My name is Andy Merton, and the poems that I will read today have the theme of animals. Animals tend to sneak into my poems, whether they were intended to be there or not. And I've learned simply to let them be when they come. So this first poem that I'm going to read is called Chickens. It's one of the very first poems that I ever had published. And it's also the only poem in all of the poems I've written which came to me in a dream. Chickens. A man said to me, "Let's get these chickens registered." There were no chickens. The man had a tiny car. We drove underneath the traffic, looking for an airport. "The only place you can register a chicken is Missouri," he explained. We couldn't find the airport, but he didn't mind. The important thing, he said, is to keep trying. So we're going from a chicken to a dog here. It's a very integral dog, an important dog, whose name is Elvis. And the poem is called The Dog. Less than a year into our rebound marriage, you, I, and Elvis the Basset Hound drove down Route 95 from Boston to Providence to visit Rex, your old high school drama teacher, who kissed you on both cheeks and your mouth. Balding, muscles going to flab, he wore a white shirt with flared sleeves open at the waist, a gold medallion hanging to his navel. The Who's rock opera Tommy blasted on the stereo. "I have a surprise," Rex tells you. "And here's Alan, your ex, up from the city, where he DJs at a Brooklyn club." We smoke some weed. Then you and Alan disappear, and Rex puts an arm around my shoulder. "See me, feel me, touch me, heal me." Elvis gives me a look, and the King and I are back on the road, his ears flapping in the wind. No way were you going to get that dog. So it seems to me a natural segue to go from dogs to platypus. I hope no one asked me why. This poem is called In the Year of the Platypus. I wrote this because I thought the zodiac was incomplete. There's the year of the lion and the year of the rat and so on, but I felt there was a need for a year of the platypus. In the year of the platypus, each letter will be written to whom it may not concern. Tomatoes will cease their laughter. Curmudgeons will sprout from the eyes of wayward potatoes. Frogs will braid a tapestry of doom. The lion shall petition to lie down with another lion. The deer and the antelope will play pinochle. At long last, the martyred Moby Dick will tell his side of the story. Ukuleles, kazoos, and accordions will inherit the earth. As for me, you will find me disguised as an inkstand, trembling in anticipation of the year of the squid. This next one is called Man and Muskrat. In my dream, I sit on the curb of a busy street in Prague, halfway between the castle on the hill and Kafka's tiny house below. It was not always this way, I tell passers-by, pointing to my three-day beard, torn jacket, and the talking muskrat by my side. Until recently, I was a normal man, dreaming normal dreams of Ava Gardner, barefoot, posing against backdrops of canyons, mountains, oceans, glens, lace curtains. Then the muskrat arrived, speaking Czech, which I realized I understood. "Do Prahy," it said, "to Prague, and here we are. Let me assure you, I have nothing against muskrats, or Prague from that matter. But I miss Ava. Can you help?" But the muskrat says, "Ignore him," and the passers-by comply. And later I awake, as I always do these days, on a bed of water lilies in Bulgaria. So there are animals to whom we don't give much thought. We take them for granted, and we probably shouldn't. As this poem points out, it's called "A Warning from the Chipmunk of Doom." And it's told by the chipmunk. "Go ahead and laugh. But when you have acted badly, not just badly, unforgivably, caused your wife, your child, for God's sake, your mother, pain they will bear always, like stigmata. When you have locked yourself away, a kernel of self-loathing, in a shell hard and small as an acorn, the last thing you see in the world will be my shadow." Okay, so we're back to chickens now. But these aren't just any chickens. These are druid chickens. And the poem mostly has to do with the titles of poems. So the title of this poem about titles of poems is, "Any poem with druid chickens in the title is likely to succeed." And it goes from there. Something that cannot be said for poems whose titles lack chickens, druids, or worse, both. I mean, which is going to be more engaging, a poem titled "What I Did on My Summer Vacation," or a poem titled "What I Did on My Summer Vacation is Nothing Compared to What a Few Determined Druid Chickens Pulled Off While Scratching Around at Hastings in 1066, or Plymouth Rock in 1620, or Outside the Sun Record Studio in Memphis, Tennessee in 1956, and never mind about the raven and the dove. Who do you think laid those six magic eggs that kept the whole horde on the ark fed all those weeks in the rain, centuries before Jesus tried to pass off the loaves and fishes trick as his own, thus bringing about the great schism that drove Christians and Druids apart forever? I mean, really." This is a poem about a very ambitious garter snake. It's called "The Lid." "I intend to become the first garter snake to master the piano. It should not be difficult once I figure out how to open the lid."
1, 2, 1, 2, 3.
"A buzzard took a monkey for a ride in the air. The monkey thought that everything was on a square. The buzzard tried to throw the monkey off his back, but the monkey grabbed his neck and said, 'Now listen, Jack. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and stay right. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top. Now what's the use of diving? Ain't no use in diving. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top. You know the buzzard told the monkey, 'You're choking me. Please release your hold, I'll set you free.' Monkey looked the buzzard
dead in the eye. I said, your story's so touching, it sounds like a lie.
Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and stay right. Straighten up and fly right.
Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top. It sounds like a lie.
Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and stay right. Straighten up and fly right.
Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top. Fly right.
Now, back yet again to a particular chicken. This one needs a little bit of an introduction. I taught for a number of years at a summer program in Cambridge in England. So I spent about 10 summers in Cambridge. And near the college, there's a wonderful burial ground called the Ascension Parish Burial Ground, where a number of well-known luminaries are buried, including the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein. And there's a lovely bench near Wittgenstein's grave where I used to sit and read and nap sometime. This starts out with an epigraph with a quote from Wittgenstein, who said, "I sit astride life like a bad rider on a horse. I only owe it to the horse's good nature that I am not thrown off at this very moment." And then the poem goes, "Just before falling asleep on a bench near Wittgenstein's grave, I notice a formidable black hen pacing near the stone of the great philosopher, who died April 21, 1951, having written only hours before, while sedated, quote, someone who, dreaming, says, 'I am dreaming,' even if he speaks audibly while doing so, is no more right than if he said in his dream, 'It is raining,' while it was in fact raining, even if his dream was connected with the noise of the rain," end quote. "Wittgenstein was wrong," I tell the hen, who cocks her head. Encouraged, I continue, "How does the fact that I am dreaming invalidate the statement, 'I am dreaming,' or for that matter, the statement, 'I am snoring,' even though my dream is graced by the rhythm of my snores? But the chicken, who I observe now, is saddled and bridled, mutters only, 'I am dreaming.'" This is another one from my Cambridge days. The title of the poem is Cricket, and I'm referring here to the game, not the insect. "Someday, someone will write a poem about the time a hedgehog ran out on a cricket patch in East Anglia during a match, and about the goshawk that swooped down and seized it. Likely it will not be the bowler whose back was turned. Perhaps it will be the wicketkeeper who saw it all. Or it may be the American University student who was in attendance that day, even though, after all these years, he is still trying to understand the game." This next one is one of these poems where it wasn't supposed to be about animals at all. They just wandered in toward the end. The title of the poem is Wilbur and Napoleon Are Already Taken. This was to be a poem about the existential nature of the human condition, staged against a backdrop of whirling galaxies, until two damp pigs wandered in from the rain, demanding to be named. This one is mostly not about animals, but there is a cameo appearance by a lion in this one. The title of the poem is Snow. At the local diner, I slip into a booth, which remains empty. Cindy, a waitress, refills mugs from pots marked good and evil. I take out a pen and write a letter of recommendation for a friend. It begins, Dear God. Benny the cook emerges to bemoan the recent spike in platypus infestations. A lion in the next booth leans over and says, This seems okay until someone wanders in from the veldt, and then I remember how long it's been since I've gnawed on a zebra. Sometimes I even miss the vultures. Outside, a small maple waves its branches wildly, like a cop shielding children from the sight of a corpse. Snow melts like disappearing paper, leaving a ragged landscape of permanent ink. And I have one more poem, and this is titled Judgment Day. A pig slits my throat. A fish disembowels me. A lobster drops me into boiling water. An ant the size of a building steps on me. A spider inadvertently tosses me into a fire along with the wood. A frog puts me in a jar filled with chloroform and screws on the lid. But also a turtle I've removed from the path of a car takes me aside and explains.
Thank you, Andy, for bringing us Elvis the Dog, Wittgenstein's Chicken, and the Explaining Turtle, along with a host of other cool cats who, it seems to me, could run the world. My guess is, though, they wouldn't want the job. And thank you, Ben and Kent, for your renditions of Louis Jordan's Barnyard Boogie, Nat King Cole and Irving Mills' Straighten Up and Fly Right, and Henry Mancini's Baby Elephant Walk. Andy's newest book, Final Exam, as well as his other collections of poetry, may be purchased most anywhere, but I'll encourage you to buy from your local bookstore, which is River Run Bookstore right here in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Call the owner, Tom Holbrook, at 603-431-2100, or go to the website at riverrunbookstore.com. Though most of the poems our community readers have brought us were written 100 years or more before Andy began making poems, They anticipate, in various ways, the surrealism that characterizes his work. Let the animal fair continue.
Hello, everyone. My name is Patrick Healy. I am very pleased to be reading The Naming of Cats by T.S. Eliot. The Naming of Cats. The naming of cats is a difficult matter. It isn't just one of your holiday games. You may think at first I'm as mad as a hatter when I tell you a cat must have three different names. First of all, there's the name that the family used daily, such as Peter, Augustus, Alonzo, or James, such as Victor or Jonathan, George or Bill Bailey, all of them sensible, everyday names. There are fancier names if you think they sound sweeter, some for the gentlemen, some for the dames, such as Plato, Admetus, Electra, Demeter, but all of them sensible, everyday names. But I tell you, a cat needs a name that's particular, a name that's peculiar and more dignified. Else how can he keep his tail perpendicular, or spread out his whiskers, or cherish his pride? Of names of this kind, I can give you a quorum, such as Munkustrap, Quaxo, or Curicopat, such as Bombellarina, or else Jelly Lorum. Names that never belong to more than one cat. But above and beyond, there's still one name left over, and that is the name that you never will guess, the name that no human research can discover, but the cat himself knows and will never confess. When you notice a cat in profound meditation, the reason, I tell you, is always the same. His mind is engaged in a rapt contemplation of the thought of the thought of the thought of his name, his ineffable, effable, effin' ineffable, deep and inscrutable regular name.
Hi, my name is Mary Anker. I'm recording from the Greens studio that sits along Chauncey Creek, off the Piscataqua River in Kittery Point, Maine. The poem I bring you is Jabberwocky by Lewis Carroll. Carroll wrote this poem in 1855 and lived from 1832 to 1898. Jabberwocky's language, sometimes described as nonsense or whimsical, still reminds us that all language can be understood through various lenses, specific and universal, personal and public, humorous and serious, historical and present day. And here is Jabberwocky by Lewis Carroll. 'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe. Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the Jubjub bird, and shun the frumious Bandersnatch. He took his vorpal sword in hand. Long time the maxim foe he sought. So rested he by the tum-tum tree, and stood a while in thought. And as in uffish thought he stood, the Jabberwock with eyes of flame came whiffling through the tulgey wood, and burbled as it came. 1, 2, 1, 2, and through, the vorpal blade went snickersnack. He left it dead, and with its head he went galumphing back. And hast thou slain the Jabberwock? Come to my arms, my beamish boy. O frabjous day, callooh, callay, he chortled in his joy. 'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe.
Thank you. My name is Tony Lee, and I live in York, Maine. And I'd like to read a poem by Robert Frost called One More Brevity. He calls it a song. I open the door so that my last look should be taken outside a house and book. Before I gave up seeing and slept, I said I'd see how Sirius kept his watchdog eye on what remained to be gone into if not explained. But scarcely was my door ajar when past the leg I thrust for bar slipped in to be my problem guest, not a heavenly dog made manifest, but an earthly dog of the carriage breed, who, having failed of the modern speed, now asked asylum, and I was stirred to be the one so dog preferred. He dumped himself like a bag of bones, and he sighed himself a couple of groans, and head to tail then firmly curled, like swearing off on the traffic world. I set him water, I set him food. He rolled an eye with gratitude, or merely manners it may have been, but never so much as lifted chin. His hard tail loudly smacked the floor, as if beseeching me, please, no more. I can't explain, tonight at least. His brow was perceptibly trouble-creased. So I spoke in terms of adoption thus, gusty old boy, Dalmatian Gus, you're right. There's nothing to discuss. Don't try telling me what's on your mind, the sorrow of having been left behind, or the sorrow of having run away. All that can wait till the light of day. Meanwhile, feel obligation free. Nobody has to confide in me. 'Twas too one-sided a dialogue, and I wasn't sure I was talking dog. I broke off baffled, but all the same in fancy I ratified his name, Gusty, Dalmatian Gus, that is, and started shaping my life to his, finding him in his right supplies and sharing his miles of exercise. Next morning, the minute I was about, he was at the door to be let out, as much as to say, I've paid my call. You mustn't feel hurt now if now I'm all for getting back somewhere or further on. I opened the door and he was gone. I was to taste in little the grief that comes of dogs' lives being so brief. Only a fraction of ours at most. He might have been the dream of a ghost in spite of the way his tail had smacked my floor so hard and matter-of-fact. And things have been going so strangely since, I wouldn't be too hard to convince. I might even claim he was serious. Think of presuming to call him Gus. The star itself, heaven's greatest star, not a meteorite, but an avatar, who had made his overnight descent to show by deeds he didn't resent my having depended on him so long and yet done nothing about it in song. A symbol was all he could hope to convey, an intimation, a shot of ray, a meaning I was supposed to seek and finding not necessary speak.
I'm Cynthia Chattis, recording from my home in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and the poem I'm going to read may be familiar to many of you. It's called The Owl and the Pussycat by Edward Lear. The owl and the pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat. They took some honey and plenty of money wrapped up in a 5-pound note. The owl looked up to the stars above and sang to a small guitar, "Oh, lovely pussy, oh, pussy, my love, what a beautiful pussy you are. You are, you are, what a beautiful pussy you are." Pussy said to the owl, "You elegant vowel, how charmingly sweet you sing. Oh, let us be married. Too long we have tarried. But what shall we do for a ring? They sailed away for a year and a day to the land where the bong tree grows. And there in a wood a piggywig stood with a ring at the end of his nose. His nose? His nose. With a ring at the end of his nose. "Dear pig, are you willing to sell for 1 shilling your ring?" said the piggy. "I will." So they took it away and were married next day by the turkey who lives on the hill. They dined on mince and slices of quince, which they ate with a runcible spoon. And hand in hand, on the edge of the sand, they danced by the light of the moon. The moon, the moon. They danced by the light of the moon.
Well, let me tell you about the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees and the moon up above and a thing called love. Well, let me tell you about a girl and a guy and the stars in the sky and made the kiss on a night like this. Now when I looked into your big brown eyes, whoa, it's so very plain to see that it's time you learned about the facts of life, starting from A to Z. Well, let me tell you about the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees and the moon up above and a thing called love. Tell them about it. Of life, starting from A to Z. Let me tell you about the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees and the moon up above and a thing called love and a thing called love, the crazy little thing called love.
Thank you, Patrick Healy, Mary Anker, Tony Lee, and Cynthia Chattis, for your wonderful readings of poems by T.S. Eliot, Lewis Carroll, Robert Frost, and Edward Lear. Thank you, too, again, Andy, for being with us for this show. We also heard Ben and Kent perform Bird Feathers, which may or may not be written by Charlie Parker. They finished with Jewel Aiken's The Birds and the Bees. What a marvelous year of rice pudding poetry and music. Thank you to all our featured poets, musicians, and community readers for keeping rice pudding alive and well, by hook or by crook. The show is engineered by Douglas Green, and our podcast art is by graphic designer Sophie Green. Abundant thanks to Rice Public Library Director Lee Perkins and Tech Services Supervisor Greta Evans, who are generous and enthusiastic in their support of this show. Our theme music is Pussy Hat, composed by Kent Allen and Joyce Anderson. I'm Kimberly Green, and I'm most thankful for you, dear listeners, near and far. Take good care, everyone, in this glorious green season of the birds and the bees. One way or another, we'll be back in the fall. I'm counting those chickens. Bye for now.